From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm Rebecca Ward, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program is Joe DiCapua, Managing Editor of Africa News Tonight. Our special guest is Mark Yarnell, a Senior Advocate with the independent advocacy group Refugees International here in Washington. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
He is an experienced advocate for displaced persons and human rights, also working previously with the relief organizations Merlin and Oxfam. He has led field assessments and projects throughout Africa and currently focuses on issues affecting the Horn of Africa, which has been devastated by famine and instability. Mr. Yarnell has lent his expertise to domestic policymakers as well, testifying before the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission, a bipartisan caucus of the U.S. House of Representatives. Pleasure to have you both here. Well, estimates put the number of people facing starvation at about 20 million in Somalia, South Sudan, Nigeria, and Yemen. There's a drought in Somalia, but that's only part of the issue, a small part perhaps. All of these countries are in the midst of conflict. So, Mark, how would you describe the conditions that have led to what one UN official called the worst humanitarian crisis since 1945?
I've been working in the sector for about 10, 15 years now, and it's absolutely overwhelming. When I first began working at Refugees International to focus on the Horn of Africa, it was in the midst of famine in Somalia. And that alone was devastating in terms of leading to 200,000 deaths, hundreds of thousands of Somalis fleeing into Kenya and Ethiopia for assistance. And so that was one situation. And now you multiply that by four simultaneously. And I think what's so challenging is that we try to talk about potential famines broadly in terms of the need for $4.4 billion, 20 million people at risk of hunger. Each particular crisis is very complex, and as you mentioned, has a combination of both conflict, poor governance, and climate conditions, including drought. So it needs both the sort of big picture focus while also being able to dig into the complexities of each one.
But it sounds like there were some early indicators that this crisis was looming. So how did it manage to escape attention until now?
It's a great question. I think tragically and historically, the international community responds once famine is actually declared. And we talk about need and emergency assistance and people who are starving. To get to famine itself, you need very specific conditions in terms of very high levels of malnutrition, very high death rates, and very, very limited availability of food. And so by the time you get to famine, you're almost too late because people are literally dying because of hunger. And I think that's been the big challenge is how do you draw attention to the issues ahead of time? And I think one of the issues is that there's so many crises. There's donor fatigue. There's sort of a feeling that the situation is so grave that we can't do anything about it. And so I think that to be able to talk about it and to be clear about what the reality is and to accept how difficult it is, but that we can do more, we can provide more assistance, we can save lives. And so while we can't solve all the issues and solve these conflicts, we can make a positive difference, and that's what we've got to focus on.
I see Joe, my colleague over there, nodding his head because he's spoken with a number of reporters, also NGOs on the ground there. What do you think about this? How did we get to this point?
We have a better early warning system now, considering going back to the 1980s when you had the disastrous famine like in Ethiopia. So they set up the famine early warning system. So we got signs early on that it was coming. And then, of course, with climate change and the drought. Problem is, from talking to a lot of organizations like yours, it's tough to get to the people in need. So you know there's a problem, but you can't always get there to help the people. What are you seeing when you go to Somalia and Kenya? How easy is it to get to those folks who need help?
That's an extremely important point because the countries that are either experiencing famine like Sudan or on the brink of famine are also experiencing very serious conflict, and the people who need help are in very dangerous areas. So South Sudan, for example, which has already been declared famine, there's been, I believe, over 80 humanitarian workers killed trying to assist people in need. In northeast Nigeria, where the situation is less related to drought and more related to the conflict is more significant on balance, aid workers can spend a lot of time in the main city, Maiduguri, the capital of Borno province. But because of Boko Haram and fighting between Boko Haram and the government, you can't get to many of the areas in Northeast. You know, in Somalia, where I was visiting late last year, where there have been, I think, 600,000 people displaced since November because of drought. Basically, when we go there, we can get to Mogadishu, we can get to cities like Kismayo, Baidoa. But outside of those cities, It's so dangerous that for us, for UN workers, for other aid workers, they're risking their lives to get to people whose lives need to be saved. So the conflict dynamic of this is so essential, and it's an important point because we can't just think that just throwing money at it will fix it. It's also addressing the roots of the conflicts.
Yeah, it's very dangerous. Every year they have World Humanitarian Day where they honor the humanitarian workers, but I don't think many people realize just how dangerous it is. Just taking a convoy, I just heard, for example, I think in testimony before the Security Council, the UN head of mission for South Sudan was saying a UN convoy trying to get to someone in need has to pass about 90 checkpoints, both of government and armed groups. So it can take weeks to get to where they need it. And Somalia, they don't even have that luxury of necessarily having convoys going to these places.
Well, and the one country that we haven't spoken of that's also on the potential for famine list, Yemen, talk about dangerous. It's brutally dangerous and extremely difficult place to operate. And you've got, you know, a conflict that is at the local level complex, but then you have Saudi Arabia and Iran and even, you know, U.S. through port involved as well. Basically, there's sort of one port on the west side of the country, Hodeidah, which is sort of a lifeline in terms of aid being able to arrive into the country. And hearing news now that the coalition troops led by Saudi Arabia want to bomb the port and try to retake it before Ramadan.
And there was a boatload of Somalis that just got shot to pieces there a few weeks ago.
So in addition to just, you know, people who are hungry and need assistance, you're dealing with these very serious conflicts, and that cannot be understated.
You were talking about the sheer numbers of displaced persons leaving these famine-ridden areas, but where are they going? And I think, as you just mentioned, one of the places they're going to is Yemen. That doesn't make too much sense.
It's really remarkable. I mean, part of that, I think, is that traditionally, as Somalia has faced periods of instability and famine, a number of Somalis have attempted to take boats to Yemen to seek assistance and or to try to find work or move further through the continent. And it's remarkable now that as bad as things are in Yemen, you still have people fleeing Somalia to try to get there. And that's just an indication of how broad the emergency is. And then you have, I think, what's another aspect of this, which is really concerning, is that generally the countries immediately bordering those that are facing the most serious emergencies have been open to welcoming refugees. So in South Sudan, Uganda to the south has been extremely generous in keeping its borders open and also sort of wanting to create a situation where people who flee, they're not stuck in camps. They can integrate into the local community, they can work, they can have access to land. And so it's been a very progressive policy. But because of the sheer numbers, because you have almost 1 million South Sudanese who have arrived in Uganda and around 2,000 a day, it's basically that system of local integration and trying to support people with a level of dignity is being overwhelmed. And Uganda is at the breaking point. And when a country like that can no longer assist people, where will they go? It's really overwhelming.
Yeah, I think Uganda has just asked for international aid to help deal with the refugee crisis it's having now.
Yeah.
Well, take us through exactly what a relief organization might do to try to get food and aid to the communities that are most in need. They have to go through, as you mentioned, a number of checkpoints, but there must be some path of least resistance that they might take.
Yeah, in South Sudan, where the front lines of the conflict keep shifting, it's quite difficult. So the UN has, it's usually last resort, but they've resorted to food drops because trying to go overland through the front lines of the conflict is quite difficult. So that's been one way to reach people in a very inaccessible areas generally. Additionally, you try to create sort of passages from bordering countries. So Sudan, while it's also played a major role in exacerbating conflict, at least in the immediate term, has opened up a corridor for assistance to pass from Sudan down into northern South Sudan. And we're also trying to push for more aid to come from Ethiopia, from Gambela in the west. So there's a lot of aid workers at very high levels every day grappling with, okay, how do we do this well? And I think what's so frustrating and something that can be dealt with is that you've got basically parties to the conflict trying to limit aid. So you've got the South Sudanese government. They want aid to get to people in their areas of control, but they don't want aid getting to people in opposition areas. And so they put up taxes, they make it hard for aid workers to get visas, there's harassment. So we really need to put a pressure on the parties to the conflict to, in spite of the conflict, at least for civilians who are caught up in this unnecessarily, allow them to get the help they need.
Have you been working with anyone in Kenya?
Yeah, I spend a good deal of time working on Kenya, and I was last there in September.
So we've been hearing a lot about the drought affecting the pastoralists, mm-hmm. and how the violence is erupting because they're actually going on to ranches and farms to feed their cattle, and people have been getting shot and killed. Mm-hmm. Do you deal with that situation at all?
To a degree. I think a good deal of my work is focused on Somalis fleeing into these areas, and I think that's an important point, is that when someone's forced out of their home country in a region that's already facing challenges, while they might arrive into a place of relative safety, they're arriving to somewhere like northern Kenya that has its own issues in terms of climate-related degradation and tensions between pastoralists and agriculturalists that can be exacerbated. So that's why it's looking at the situation in totality and saying you can't just focus on providing aid to the refugees who have fled. You also have to help the host communities who are receiving them. And this is a perfect example, and I think that's where you have to have a pretty holistic response.
You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Mark Yarnell, a senior advocate at Refugees International, an independent advocacy group that works to end displacement based in Washington. Also joining me on the program is Joe DiCapua. He's the managing editor of Africa News Tonight. I'm Rebecca Ward, sitting in for Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You can also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Madi Yassir. She's a fan from Stuttgart, Germany. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Once again, Mark Yarnell of Refugees International joining us today on Press Conference USA, along with my colleague, Joe DiCapua, and we've been talking about the humanitarian crisis in the Horn of Africa, as well as other places like Yemen and Nigeria, where some 20 million people face the possibility of starvation. Much of the reason for food insecurity is the instability in many of those communities. And so I want to talk to you a little about the politics involved in some of these conflicts. And here in the U.S., current administration has said that they are going to cut aid. And how much would that affect what you're trying to do, organizations like Refugees International? What would that do to helping the people who are in need?
It's a critical question. And as we're here in Washington, I think to drill down into it, where you have the situation of the needs in terms of those who need emergency assistance increasing, and then you have the U.S., which has traditionally been a leader in responding to these crises, threatening to cut aid. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people will die as a result of this. We can't understate it. And yes, you need to ask for support from the European Union. I'm originally from Canada. Canada is a small country, is looking to increase its support as well. You need a holistic response, but no one country or even coalition of countries can replace the role that the U.S. plays. And it's not just in terms of dollar amounts. When the U.S. responds, like when they responded last year when there was drought in Ethiopia, it was a catalyst. They responded and then other countries came in as well. And so I think that while the budget process is still being sorted out and we don't know exactly how it's going to conclude, when the U.S. is sending signals that it is planning to cut aid and maybe even fold USAID, the development agency, into State Department, I think it sends shockwaves across the world and to other donors in terms of how they'll be able to respond. There's limits to what we can do. I think that we have to be realistic about the complexities of the conflict in South Sudan, the conflict in Nigeria, the conflict in Yemen, the conflict in Somalia. So it's accepting that there's long-term efforts to resolve that violence, but at least let's help where we can. And in a place like Somalia, where yes, there's still conflict, but the government is a really willing and able partner. There's more government control over various parts of the country, where the drought is more of an impact than the conflict. Aid will make a difference and will save lives. And to be cutting it at this point, it's shameful. It's embarrassing. I'm glad you guys are covering this. It's something that as a refugee advocacy organization is just going to seize all our time and attention until we make improvements.
To be fair, I have to point out that one of the reasons for the idea of the cut in aid or the cut to the State Department and USAID is that there is some redundancy. Mm-hmm. There's also criticisms about the aid not getting to the people in need, mm-hmm. actually going to the extremist groups that are exacerbating the situation. If you were able to speak to the people in charge of doling out the money, how would you make your case? Look, this can be done, but we've got to do it this way.
Very important point, because just throwing money at problem, if it's not done well, will not address it. And we have to be consistently focused on trying to improve the effectiveness of aid, and as you said, making sure that aid gets to the people who need it. And so I think that we need to be able to bring concrete recommendations on how aid can be more effective, and where monitoring is needed, and where cooperation has to be improved. And if there are redundancies, then by all means, those can be reduced. But to take an approach where it seems to me the approach right now is just simply cut the aid and don't look at how it can be made more effective. So one example is I spend a lot of time working in Somalia, and because of the dynamics there and because Kenya has become more reluctant to receive refugees into its country, the vast majority of people displaced from this drought have been going to urban areas, to Mogadishu, to Kismayo, to Baidoa. And unfortunately, in some of those areas, warlords have been able to control some of the IDP camps, and they've been able to divert aid. They've been able to exploit the IDPs, which is obviously an issue that needs to be addressed. And so our focus has been, let's highlight that. Let's get better monitoring. Let's work with the government to impose penalties on those that are harming IDPs. And let's work to make sure the aid gets those people who need it. So let's do that. But just to cut aid without those considerations, I think only leads to more problems.
Joe, what do your sources tell you about that?
Well, this was actually done with PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, right? The funding has been sort of flat in recent years, but it's become a very, very efficient program, doing exactly what Mark said. They looked at the programs, which one worked, which could they get the most out of for the money. So it's an example that might be applied in this situation, although, of course, you're not necessarily dealing with all that conflict. But, you know, we talk about 20 million people. It's such a staggering figure, it's hard to do that. And sometimes it's helpful to put a human face on these things. Have you met some of these refugees or migrants, and have they told you what they've been through to get to safety?
I appreciate the chance to describe this, because the U.S., I think, has been very strong at trying to support, especially in the Horn of Africa, refugees who have been arriving from Somalia into Kenya. Kenya now says that it wants to shut down the refugee camp in Dadaab in the northeast, and that all Somalis must go home.
And that's hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, there's about 250,000 Somalis living in the Dadaab camp right now. And so in the past, the U.S., I think, with some more leadership, could work with Kenya and urge them, okay, what kind of assistance can we provide you and make sure that the camp is safe, that people have what they need, that it's not taking away from the host communities. But when the U.S. is now itself closing its doors to refugees, it's harder to push that message. So we went out to Dadaab to find out what the potential impact would be. And what we found is that people, they were pressured by the Kenyans to leave, so they would go back to Somalia. But then upon arriving in Somalia, because of the drought, because of conflict, would flee right back to Kenya. But now that the camp might be closed, they don't know where they're going to go. They can't go back to Somalia. Maybe they can't stay in Kenya. Will they pay smugglers to try to flee into Europe? The chances to come to the U.S. are less frequent. Just briefly, there was one young 17-year-old named Abdi who we met when we were there. He had done this with his family living in Dadaab. They made the effort to repatriate to Somalia. When he arrived, very shortly after, he was received direct threats from an armed group. He was worried about being recruited into their ranks, and so he fled back again to Kenya and now is living in the Dadaab refugee camp. But amid all this uncertainty, he has safety right now. But if the camp is ultimately closed, his future is completely uncertain. So it's these kinds of stories we want to highlight to people, that we have to do better. It's both providing immediate services, but also finding long-term solutions.
How can the international community, the United States, how can we stabilize these areas politically in order to get aid to the people and to prevent this from happening again? What can you do to prevent this kind of crisis? Is there any answer at all?
Well, there's two things. First, we can't have this conversation without talking about climate change and the impact that has. And I think that when we look at recurrent droughts and the fact that Somalia, which experienced a famine in 2011, could be on the brink of famine again, it's staggering the impact of climate-related displacement. So being a leader on climate change and reducing its impact is serious. And then secondly, I think it requires sort of balanced engagement and balanced leadership. So again, in the case of Somalia, there's a government that is new and maybe fledgling, but is ready to work with the international community. And I think that working with them to build institutions so that they can play a role themselves at providing assistance and building durability. But when we have a focus on counterterrorism and we're focusing on bombing terrorist organizations, that's part of U.S. national security interest. But if that's the only part, then we lose the chance to support these governments which need our support.
Oxfam, the organization you used to work for, the regional director, just said that climate change is making these crises worse. and he gave the examples of donkeys and camels. Normally hardy animals, they're dying off. So when you think of camels dying of thirst, that's pretty frightening.
There also are some environmental issues outside of climate change that can be addressed, and that is degradation of the soil, better farming practices. Does your organization, maybe not yours in particular, but work hand in hand with what would be called best practices of agriculture, of retraining subsistent farmers and other people to kind of take better care of the land that they have despite facing drought?
Certainly, and kind of in the effort to learn lessons from the impact of the Somalia famine in 2011, there was sort of this movement to support communities to build resilience. And it kind of became the buzzword of how do we work with communities, whether they're pastoralists, agriculturalists, to implement practices so that in the face of environmental degradation and climate change, they're in a better place to remain resilient. And I think that there have been some great programs that were implemented. And at the local level, there's some communities that are benefiting. But it's just happening at a very small scale. And so you have sort of small pockets of areas where communities are implementing practices that make them more resistant to drought. But when you look at the whole country, it's not even close to being scaled at the level it needs to be. So there's some good things happening, but just at a very small level.
And the main issue, of course, is getting food aid to the people in need and somehow bypassing or avoiding exacerbating the conflict there. So what can the international community do to not aid the militants while helping the people most in need?
Well, we need to be smart about it. And I think that there are certainly cases in history where aid was just sort of pushed into an area without monitoring it. And then it ended up being utilized by different factions in the conflict dynamics. And the perfect example of that is in Sudan when there was the civil war between the South and the North. And basically food was just dropped and then it was hoped it would get to the people, but it ended up often being diverted by armed groups. So what happens now is that to great risk, aid workers, particularly from the World Food Program, they themselves go to the areas where the food will be dropped. They set up systems. They find out who needs it. They evaluate the context so that when the food is dropped, they're there themselves to help make sure it's delivered to the right people. So we need to recognize there's been major problems, but then learn from that. And this is one example where I think there's been improvement.
The Food and Agriculture Organization, just to add to what Mark was saying, is also trying to provide farmers with seeds as they gear up for hopefully a good rainy season, but it's not looking very good. They're also restocking the livestock of the pastoralists to try to keep them going and vaccinating the animals because when you have drought and whatnot, the animals get sick. So that's going on at the level two to try to ward off famine.
Right, because once a family loses their livestock, to reconstitute that and reestablish that from scratch is so difficult that many people are never able to go back to it. So if you can prevent the livestock from dying in the first place, that has a huge, huge impact.
Somalia has had a history of drought. So this is something that has occurred before. The other countries are not so much facing drought as facing conflict. And then, as you said, taking in refugees from other areas fleeing conflict. So it still comes back to the question of delivering food aid without getting it into the hands, because what I've read is that if the food aid gets into the hands of the extremists or the militants or the people who are actually exacerbating conflict, they're also taking bribes. And I was once told by, this was some years ago with previous conflict, but someone from Oxfam told me that, yes, they have to pretty much pay the militants or the rebels in a certain area in order to get through the food aid. So that just seems counterintuitive.
Right. And I think that, again, aid organizations and those that are on the ground, they're faced with these dilemmas every day. And I think that part of the role of a group like ours, an independent advocacy organization, is to spend time and understand when is it appropriate to make that trade-off that, yes, some of the aid might not get to where it needs to go, but a lot of it will, and that's going to save lives and it's worthwhile. Or when is it a situation where it's just so dangerous, we have no idea where it's going to get to, and it could make things worse than better. And in that case, maybe reevaluate where you're providing aid. But I think what needs to be emphasized is that there are experienced, thoughtful aid workers that are making the decisions every day. And so it isn't just a situation of let's roll the trucks in and push the food out. It's thinking about if we provide the aid in a certain place, are people going to cross a front line to get to it? And that would certainly make things worse. Or again, like if it's a situation like Mogadishu, are people going to kind of be held hostage by these gatekeepers who want the aid for themselves? And in those cases, you need to think, are you potentially making things worse? And if that's the case, then you reevaluate, but then you provide it where you can. And again, this gets back to providing smart aid. So But if the aid isn't even available, you can't even make those choices. So at least allow the aid community the opportunity to be making those choices, have donors monitor to see how it's happening, and then do the best we can for the people who need it. But don't just cut off the lifeline entirely.
And the UN has to play a role, because the UN has missions in South Sudan, and some have been very critical of the mission, although Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, says it's doing a better job. But they have to escort the convoys. They have to help protect the aid workers and the AU in Somalia. So it can't be just the humanitarian organizations. It can't be just up to them. They're not there to fight. They're there to save people. So they're between a rock and a hard place. If they're all alone and they're facing this, what would you do? You'd give some food to get through to help the... But you need armed escorts very often. Happened in Central African Republic.
Mm-hmm. Mark, you mentioned that Somalia, we have a willing partner, if a weak partner. But what can the international community do to help to get that kind of cooperation or to facilitate cooperation among the countries that are having these issues?
Right. So this is where you get to looking at, on the one hand, the broad need of the 20 million people starving, and then you want to dig into some of the specifics. And I think that, you know, a situation like South Sudan, you need a ceasefire, right? I mean, it's until we get a ceasefire between the President Kiir and the opposition leader Machar, in addition to the various factions that have come around. So there needs to be major attention on working with the warring parties to at least have some kind of pause so that people can receive the assistance they need while famine has already been declared. And I fear that with the sort of U.S. policy of more isolationism and less engagement in these international situations, that the U.S. may not play a potential role in that, which I think will be a mistake. In Nigeria, again, it's a situation where the government has very legitimate security concerns and is trying to fight the terrorist group Boko Haram. But when the approach to fighting Boko Haram is, let's cut off supplies to Boko Haram, which will also cut off supplies to the people, which will starve people who are not associated with Boko Haram, and it's entirely militarily focused campaign, and you have an IDP camp in Ran near the border of Cameroon, which was bombed, and it had 100 IDPs killed. I think that you can rethink the balance of that. And then again, in Yemen, yes, we live in the real world, and there's a major conflict there, and it's incredibly complex, and it can't just be viewed as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, because there's so much more happening at the local level. But when I think 70% of the food aid for the country comes in through the port in Hodeidah, if that's attacked and bombed and is cut off of a lifeline, when you've got 18 million people who need food aid, well, you're going to make the situation worse. And so I think that we really need to work. And that's the challenge, right? It's like, it's not just one of these things. It's looking at all of them. And that's where I hope that the U.S. can kind of reestablish its leadership role in not doing things on their own, but in bringing the international community together to try to solve some of these challenges.
Do you sense a willingness from South Sudan to broker some kind of ceasefire?
No. And I think that the deaths of famine, the deaths from the violence, that is at the hands of the leaders of South Sudan. And that's, I think, what's so devastating, is that you don't see any willingness on the government, and we have to be honest about that. And so what do you do? And how does the international community respond to that? And what kind of sanctions do Kenya, Uganda, Sudan, Ethiopia? I mean, I think that those neighboring countries, if they got together and had a consistent approach, they could put some pressure, but they also have their own interests and their own economic pursuits within South Sudan, so that cooperation hasn't happened yet. And in Nigeria, I think there's a willingness to deal with it, and the governor of Borno State in northeast Nigeria is himself hosting IDPs. But again, when the emphasis is on a military response, it's not balanced, and you end up causing more harm than good, I think.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for your terrific insights. It's an issue that will not be solved anytime soon, and certainly not easily. Mark Yurnell is a senior advocate at Refugees International. Thank you again. And joined here today by Joe DiCapua, managing editor of Africa News Tonight. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zaleski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Thomas Blundett. I'm Rebecca Ward, sitting in for Carol Castile. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.